ัมมังสังฆังนมัสสามิขอโอกาสพระเดชพระคุณหลวงพ่อแล้วก็ครูบาอาจารย์ So I'd like to ask permission from the Sangha to say a few words to the Dhamma practitioners at Wat Pali Lai in Singapore, which is a great honor for me. And I'm filling in the time until Lompo Liam is ready to come down. But I honestly would like to give my anumotana, my feelings of appreciation and joy for all of you here gathered for practice. In a secular world, we uphold the Dhamma through our practice in our hearts. In a city or in an environment that sometimes takes other things as its refuge, it's very important that each one of us has a true sense of inclining towards the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha as a refuge. Otherwise, it's very difficult to live a good life and very difficult to end the causes of suffering. So we use whatever resources we have deep inside in our hearts to draw on that in order to not go in line with superficial things, with egotistical things, with behavior of ourselves and others that follows the easier way. The easy way is to give way to the sense of I like it and I don't like it, therefore I do it and therefore I don't do it. But we come to that sense of what is necessary in terms of the teachings of the Lord Buddha and the teachings of the Krubajans, that we come back to that point. If it's necessary, if it's appropriate, if it's the right thing to do, I'll just do what I need to do. The Buddha many times talked about heedlessness and negligence and warned us of like wasting our life away and doing things that won't actually help us to end causes of suffering. But sometimes we run after things and possibly increase the amount of unsatisfactoriness. So we all need some clarity. And it's not so easy to find clarity if the surroundings sometimes are oriented at other values than what we truly think is needed in terms of the teachings of the Lord Buddha. So it's very good to come together as a group and have evenings, mornings, and afternoons where we gather to practice the Dhamma together and sometimes listen to teachings and to have contact not only to teachers, the monks and novices, but also to other practitioners, and that we support each other in good practice. For example, like that we give each other moral support, that we don't just give way to the foolish things where people are heedless in the world, where they cut the corners, take the easy way out, or take advantage of each other. That we have a culture within our group of Dhamma friends that we support going against the grain if it's necessary, if it's correct. A sense of doing things that are hard to do. If others don't support them, we still have our inner backbone. And how do we get that? So the help and the sharing of others, but also through our own contribution in building up our practice. When we are having the opportunity to be alone, for example, when we're having time just to take a little time out away from the busyness, away from the city, away from family, away from our job. Take a little time and then recollect the teachings of the Buddha and recollect what you sometimes experience when you close your eyes and sit meditation. It's not that you can always come back to the same way of meditating in every situation. Each situation is really different. And sometimes there are many factors that are the ingredients that help us or hinder us in meditation. So many times there are things that are beyond our control as well. And our mind state itself sometimes is a bit of an obstacle. Sometimes it's in the way because it's still attached to stuff that we've been just been doing just before we came here, for example. So the sense of refuge, that means to go back to some safe place, that's the way to counter the scatteredness and the undecisiveness that sometimes come when we don't really reflect and revert to our sense of inside, where we know how things can feel and how things can become peaceful. It's not always easy, but I think all of us have practiced quite a bit. I hear that you're doing sometimes night practices with chanting and sometimes sitting together outside in the park and sometimes here in Wat Balilai and sometimes with visiting ajahns and sometimes alone. So I think everybody will also have had some periods where he feels happiness inside and feels that things are working out in the way that we wish to truly inside. There is joy and peace coming up in our mind. Not only the attempts to make the mind peaceful, but that the peace arises sometimes spontaneously. So a little kind of idea of what might work or what has worked before, or a little recollection. As you may have noticed, we just chanted in Pali in the beginning the recollection of the Buddha, the Anusati. That means just to remind oneself and think back of the feelings that we have towards the qualities of the Buddha, for example, or the qualities of the Dhamma, or the qualities of the Sangha. And not in a theoretical way, but from the heart, just to take a moment just to really think about our inner inspiration with being disciples, being Buddhists, being people that are practicing the Buddha's path. Then we just take a little moment just to go back to the original faith, inspiration, and the wonder or the miracle or the marvelous feelings that all of us share towards the enlightened teacher. And we try to feel in our inner heart this little seed of refuge, this little seed of coming back to what really matters for us in our life. And then when we feel it, we expand our feeling, we dwell on it. We take our deep in-breaths and really think, if there's nothing else in the world, what would that be like? We go deep into the feeling of immersing ourselves into faith, into the aspiration to let go and emulate the qualities of the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. It starts with reminding ourselves and not being scattered and not being heedless, not being distracted. And so many times we maybe do find joy in distraction or do things that are maybe worthwhile for a short time. But there's also many periods during the day, during the week, during the month, during the year that we do actually have time for ourselves and time to go back to the roots of what is important for us in our life. I'm saying this because I myself kind of come from, I think, quite a similar way of life before I ordained, living in Berlin in Germany in a big city. Lots of business, lots of worldly aims that people pursue. In fact, there's very few people that are actually religious people. Most of them are business people or like working on some project or the other, rushing, or students trying to learn something about all the book knowledge in the world. And I was also studying and also had my timetable, also had to run to the underground to catch it in time. Like coming late in Germany is not considered very beautiful. I think it's similar to Singapore. We share a sense of effectivity in our worldly pursuits. And at the same time, the feeling of what is most precious for myself like was triggered through meditation retreats and encounters with teachers from Asia, sometimes teachers from Thailand, sometimes teachers from other traditions. And just like you, on a Saturday evening, many times I would just come to a place where there's a Buddhist society or a group that is meditating together and just try to refresh and come back to this feeling of there is something more important to life than getting one's job done, looking after, say, family or paying the bills or making a tax declaration. All kinds of things that come to my mind. I kind of forgot a bit like Ajahn X and Ajahn Satya, and definitely Lumpur Liem, living in the well-protected area of the monastery where we have a clear-cut culture of a spiritual community or a religious community of seekers of the same aim. Forget how it is if one has to step in and out, come back out and in into this protected framework. But I do remember that when I was rushing back from the underground one time in Berlin, long before I ordained, when I was practicing like you, like going to groups, going to meditation retreats, doing chanting a little bit, not too much, that I was instructed to keep the meditation word Buddho in my mind, which of course is something new for somebody who comes from Europe or America. We don't have that intimate relationship with the Buddha as you might have it, as being born in a culture of Buddhism. But yet the word of the Buddha and just the connotations with it, they seemed so precious and so otherworldly and so peaceful that it did mean a lot to keep this meditation word in mind and trying to keep it in an even way together with the breath, just flowing in and out naturally in the rhythm of the breath. It was almost seemed like a magic shield towards the people in the underground, towards the traffic. And I don't think I was walking around spaced out, going to be hit by the next car, but kind of in a different mode than I would usually be, in a mode of seeing that there is something beyond all the superficial things that we do and that people around me do. And going back to the sense of there is a quality of peace and wisdom and enlightenment in this world, and we have the key to that in our hand or in our mind. So this repeating the meditation word Buddho. One evening I just walked back the 10 minutes from the underground back to my flat, just thinking Buddho, Buddho, and I just felt just as peaceful and just as joyful as if I was in the meditation room of my Buddhist group. I thought, that's amazing. You can carry actually this this power of the Buddha with you. You can carry it out of the room, you can take it out in the streets, and you can use it with its full potential, that actually my subjective feeling was just as good as when I was with the others meditating on and sitting and walking together and chanting. And I think it hinged upon keeping it alive and keeping it as a presence and recollecting that this is what I want to do. I don't want to be carried away by things that are unessential and don't matter. And use the word Buddho as almost like a magnet of all these wholesome feelings. And I think many of us probably are using meditation words or recollections or techniques in our practice in order to develop the practice more and more and be able to revert to some system. So all of us have accumulated experience. Sometimes it works, and sometimes it doesn't work. Sometimes we can crack the nut and come into that inner shell of well-being, and sometimes we're just trying to get a hold of it and just open it from all, try to open it from all kinds of aspects, but we don't really get in. And sometimes we just go by the motions. We think, okay, these are the instructions, I'll just do them and go, 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 go. And then it becomes mechanic even. We can be with the breath and fall asleep even while breathing. And we can also go on a trip around the world while breathing. And using the word Buddho sometimes is just a sound around our mental activity. We can still go and plan our next week and inwardly use the meditation word Buddho without stopping. But it's then just like background noise. But it's not a recollection of the Buddha. It's not a recollection of the qualities that we would like to have in our heart. So whenever we have the opportunity to really reset ourselves, and with a little sense of bringing up an urgency and saying, look, let's do this properly now. Let's really think about the Buddha. Let's really think about the Dhamma. What if the Buddha was present? What if one of his disciples was present and was here? Then we would truly be motivated. What happened when in these days when everything was joyful and happy, and there was a source of energy, just to recollect that experience and come back to that, and not just go through the motions and go through the happenings of our normal life, but take these things and recycle them, go back to the original inspiration, or go back to the feelings that that come up every now and again when we let go and when we are sitting and truly feel the qualities of the Buddha. I think some of us have maybe been to Thailand, and some of us maybe have been even to India. And it's a funny thing, if one thinks about, for example, a very precious holy site that one has visited, not holy in that sense that there's something magical going on, but holy that it's really genuinely Dhamma there. There's genuinely a sense of practice and spirit of peace there. And when we have visited a place like that, sometimes this energy overwhelms us and we are very, very faithful, and there's piti, pleasure, rapture, joy in our hearts. Sometimes we meet a Kruba Ajahn, for example, when Lumpur Liem comes, we might feel very, very happy and then very peaceful, just seeing seeing his presence. I do feel like that. And then if we have these incidents where the feelings of faith and devotion and the feeling of peace make it into our heart, then it leaves a strong memory. For example, just simply thinking about Bodh Gaya and the Bodhi tree sometimes makes one very, very peaceful. I don't know what it is, but you can try. If you have only one incident where you feel really happy and at ease, to revisit it and associate this feeling of peace and being happy with everything, being in the Dhamma, to associate that with what you're doing right now and come back to it. Associate it with the word Buddho, use it as a container and fill all this in there, and then take it out every now and again when you need it. It's like literally like a resource or a refuge accumulated in your heart. I also have a little rosary bead, like, which of course is not quite the orthodox Theravada practice, but you see many monks use this as a way of counting. For example, when you chant the Itipiso, you count 108 times. It's quite good not to have a digital counter, but to have a rosary thing. You can just kind of tack off one by the other. But sometimes you can just simply look at this rosary or take it into your hand, and it reminds you of all the energy that you put into this chanting, all your practice while you were reciting Itipiso or while you're doing Buddho. It's like as if it is in the rosary beads. I studied some science before. I'm not really into occult things, and I'm not into psychic phenomena, but this is basic psychology. You see a symbol and you take the symbol to the heart, and sometimes the symbol can be physical, like a rosary bead, or it can be a nice Buddha image, or it can be a living person, or it can be an abstract idea. For example, if you one's mind goes easily towards, the Dhamma, sometimes our refuge may not so much be the person, may not so much be the historical Buddha or the lifetime of the Buddha, but it may be just the idea there is something like freedom from suffering, there is this feeling of enlightenment. I've thought it through, I've heard it, and the teachers say it, and then it can be this feeling of refuge. And sometimes it is the living examples that we see, not in the past, not in the books, but teachers, virtuous people, people that have practiced, and we don't need to count and think in terms of, is he attained or not? Is he this or that? Can I label him or her? But just go back to the feeling of encountering a spiritual person that is motivating for you in your practice, or has been at any point of your practice, and revisit it. So then we have the Buddha, Dhamma, and the Sangha as a practical refuge, which we can use while we're in the car, while we're on the bicycle, while we're walking back from work, while we're going to the canteen. We actually don't have to tell anybody. It could be just simply the word Buddho, Buddho, that we use in a sense of countering the worldly ways around us, and knowing that there is something else, and knowing that deep inside one can get access to this. So I think this is very much a practice that you can do in Singapore, and have to do in Singapore, because the icons outside, as beautiful and well thought as they are, they speak of things that people want to be, want to have. They speak of quantity, they speak of size, they speak of efficiency, which is all very good in many ways. But the qualities of the heart and the qualities that we revert to when we sit down and meditate, You can't measure them, you can't tell about them even. You can't take a photo of them. Yeah, you can't Google them. You have to recollect by yourself, you have to come to them through your own virtues and through the own accumulation of experience with them. And it doesn't have to be talking about it. Nobody has to know about it. You can carry it as in your heart, in your chest, as a little treasure or as a source of good energy. Sometimes this happens not only with, say, Buddha Dhamma Sangha, but it can also be other recollections. There are many anusattis, recollections that the Buddha recommended. For example, the recollection of generosity, or the recollection of the devas. Sometimes living in a secular world, this can be uplifting very much if we just think, what happens if a human being leaves this material world through death and rises up to some more fine spiritual being, like a deva, or even more refined, like a Brahma. This is not thinking we want to channel this deva in order to get good exams or good results or lottery numbers, which is so many times the case in Asia, that people pray to devas in order to get something. That would be the worldly way again, wanting to be, wanting to get, thinking in terms of quantity, but thinking in terms of the quality. We can just recollect that the human realm, where we have technology and where we have all the jobs and the monetary world, finance, is not the only one. Or what I just said, generosity. Sometimes there's something really beautiful happening in the human realm, that people let go of something that they possess and give it to somebody else. So a real generous heart, through a real support, metta, real loving kindness and non-selfishness. You can think of the beauty of these qualities. And sometimes in this list of recollections, there's even very abstract qualities. Say Buddha Dhamma Sangha, you can find ways of relating to through history, through knowledge, and the experience in daily life maybe makes it possible to see certain qualities in other people that you like to emulate or recollect. But there's one recollection that the Buddha recommended as the last of the list of 10 recollections, is Upasamanusati. It's like recollecting peace. And this means recollecting the capacity to let go of all the busyness and the drama that we make in life, the frustration, the sorrow, and coming to what the Buddha described as ultimate peace. And the word upasamanusati, it sounds maybe not so familiar, but it actually means to recollect the qualities of Nibbana, of enlightenment. And this is something, whenever we have the feeling of peace in our heart, maybe even only for a short period, maybe only one instance of letting go and relaxing in a world of stress, there's a key of that, a key to that upasama, to that peace that the Buddha took to the ultimate. So it's up to us to really find access to these qualities and not get deluded by whatever our tasks are, whatever our job is, whatever we have to quickly do, and go back to these otherworldly qualities, either directly through recollecting the teachings, recollecting our chanting, using our meditation word, or using the mala beads and using our imagination, our experience to reconnect, or just through being, finding a little inkling of changing one's attitude, and then just letting this unfold and blossom. And sometimes these things happen very spontaneously, and sometimes in unexpected situations, even we're able to direct our mind to the qualities of Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, or of peace. And how often, or how many times, or how easy we flip into this mode of the otherworldly experience really depends on how much we buy into the opposite or not. So to have the right inclination in what we do in our activities and set up our life in a way that we grant opportunities for the Dhamma to arise, create little periods where we can practice, create incidents where we are reminded by our surroundings, like in the monastery or like in our meditation group, be reminded that there is this other dimension of life, and not just waste our time doing the necessary worldly jobs. So coming together and putting time aside, having quality time for oneself, this is how much we do this, the easier it will get to transport our feeling of having this quality as a refuge into other situations. And I think Ajahn Chah is very, very skillful in teaching a whole way of life to his students, not just a technique and not just a very clear outlined specific situation. He didn't even say it's only for Asians or Thais. He even opened it up for Westerners, and he even took it all the way to Europe and America. And his approach was very broad, as far as I can see in the practice. You can look into the teachings that he left behind. There's things like everything is Dhamma, or things that that we sacrifice. Whenever we sacrifice, then we're practicing the Dhamma. There's very, very broad teachings in there that we can transport into our life and use as a bridge to our personal experience where things come up easily. At the same time, he allowed people very clearly, you know, to look at the whole picture. For example, what we just chanted, the Noble Eightfold Path, to have a sense of sila as a grounding, as a way of feeling honest and good and genuine about one's actions, without remorse, without regrets, without anything to fear, as a basis to have sila, or for the monks, the vinaya, the rules, the etiquette, the form, the conventions, to have that as a part of our practice, where we take these things very, very scrupulous. We try to be as efficient as we are in our job, and as efficient as we are when we have to keep up with the secular world, as efficient we are in our sila. We use the conventions and perfect ourselves in the way we walk, we sit, we pay respects in our routine, we have a sense of self-discipline, and not just let things go according to our likes and dislikes. And then there's a sense of samadhi, the formal meditation practice, where we have a clear outline in the morning, in the evening, sometimes in the afternoon if you have time on a weekend. But do things regularly and do things continually, and have a sense of applying yourself to this difficult task of sometimes telling the world to stop and find a quiet place and sit and do walking meditation, going against the hindrances, against drowsiness, and So Lompa Cha many times, like a lot of the talks, is giving support to arouse energy to practice. And then Panya, the third part of the Noble Eightfold Path, anything that has to do with coming to that sense of understanding, knowledge, and true realization of the Dhamma, of things that the Buddha has outlined as something that we hear about and that we read about and that possibly is transmitted to us, and then to reflect upon it and find a wise attitude towards life using all those factors of the teachings. For example, the Four Noble Truths, the three characteristics, the outlines that the Buddha gave, and we ponder upon them and relate them to our lives and make them a reality. And Ajahn Chah was very good in using simple phrases, like, for example, instead of using the meditation word Buddho, he sometimes recommended just to use the word Maine in Thai, or not sure. With every breath, tell yourself, not sure, not sure, not sure. These are very, very simple ways of opening up the gate towards developing panya. Panya doesn't mean in our way of seeing things, doesn't mean that you have accumulated a lot of knowledge about Pali, or you are able to compare the Madhyamika philosophy of Nagarjuna with the teachings of Ajahn Buddhadasa, or I'm just giving examples, like things that you have read about. But panya means like to be able to use the Buddha's teachings in a wise way wherever you are, and so that it comes from your heart. It's not just hearsay, but it's opening the gate of a genuine intuitive understanding of what is happening in nature and in you. So these are a few pointers to offer to our group here that has come together. I'm very grateful to be here, and it was also very nice to see Singapore today, and the reflection I gave now is mainly triggered to being brought back to my own past. Living in a big city in Germany is maybe not as efficient and not as developed as Singapore, but the tasks for the meditator to fill the things that are happening in the secular world around one, maybe quite similar from Berlin to Singapore. The fact that we all long for something very, very deep that takes us beyond all suffering, and try to keep the access to that, whether you're up in town or whether in the meditation hall. So I offer that for reflection tonight.
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Maybe we can have some questions. Well, tonight, anybody has any questions? Anyone has any questions?
Evening, Mante. When someone renounce, and his or her loved one say okay, because her loved one also a Buddhist, but the person who want to renounce actually thinking that his loved one say okay, but he thought that maybe another few years when he's more ready, is because he still couldn't let go of his loved one. So, well, the question is not very clear.
Somebody says yes, but he doesn't really want to let go.
Yeah, maybe he hoped that he said, oh no. But when he said yes, because he's also a Buddhist, he's also practicing, so it makes the situation more difficult. So the question is, should he just go ahead, or should he, because he still have the attachment of the loved one, but he has already quite firm of the renunciation, should he just go ahead, or give him he himself another few months, or... Or waiting for the condition.
I think it's very important to be, one, sensitive to other people, but at the same time also very clear about what makes oneself most happy. And I think it supports each other. If one gives the honest sensitivity and the gesture of respect towards another person and is not just pushing one's own way, but works on making it very clear that this is a genuine wish and it's not just a lip service, or it's not just a superficial question. It may take a little more time to get the message across, but I'm sure if it's both sides are respectful and genuine in their way of relating to each other, and to the person that wants to renounce is really intent on it and sees it as his main perspective in life, that there will be a way of like communicating this in not too long time, that the honesty about it is so much. If like if there's a real honest relationship of love and respect for a couple, for example, we genuinely want our partner to be really happy, and if the partner would have to travel to another country for business reasons, we'd also say yes with a big sigh. It's good for you, it's good for us, I allow you, you know. And even more so for spiritual reasons, I think it depends on the quality of honesty and openness about it. And maybe the first thing was maybe a slip of the tongue, thinking yes, I say yes to this, but later, oops, I wasn't quite ready. But the fact that as a primary reaction, one sometimes, out of kindness to the other person, agrees to things. In Thai, they have a word for that, is to be greng jai, you know, to be a bit like too timid to say no. This may be a bit the situation that one describes, you know, like, deep down inside, one has reservation, but out of kindness and out of respect to the others, one allows it first, but later hopes for an opportunity to say, look, actually, there's something I would like to add to this or object to or so. But this sense of being greng jai, or this sense of allowing the other person, actually is a real good quality. It means genuinely, I don't want to interfere with you. Generally, I trust that you can do the right thing. And as my intuitive reaction, I would never say no. I think this is many times that what we feel when our kid asks us a favor or so, we actually don't want to discipline or say no. We want it to get what it truly wishes. And many times we get weak and say spontaneously yes, and later we, with that trust of having said yes, we put in a little reminder or reservation or so. And I think this spontaneous reaction of really a spontaneous unreflected support maybe is a good indication that actually it is okay for the other person to go his own way. I was thinking about this greng jai principle. So to be too timid to say no is what happened to Venerable Nanda, who is the Buddha's relative. At his wedding, the Buddha used a skillful means to call Nanda to take the bowls of the Buddha and wash it and carry it, more or less like our layman here. And then the Buddha just more or less kind of pulled him right into the Nikota Rama and then said, so you want to ordain, huh? Could be like a Kruba Ajahn saying this to somebody. And out of being too timid to say no and being just too faithful and too wanting to harmonize with the Buddha, automatically Nanda said yes, but he just married actually. So it's a bit like that, like with genuine spontaneous devotion. Even the Buddha used that to get Nanda to ordain. So if you get a superficial or like first take yes for some big step in your life, and it's a genuine good step, and you trust that deep down inside your partner would wish you to be going the way that is truly meaningful for you, then just go for it. But give it a bit of time to clarify that it's really all right.
Anyone? No need to be shy.
Ajahn, good evening, Ajahn. May I know what motivates you to become a bhikkhu, and in what conditions you came to Thailand to ordain?
What was the reason?
What motivates you to become a bhikkhu?
What motivates me? Okay.
This is what motivated me to come to Thailand and become a bhikkhu. It's a question that is so difficult to answer, and there's so many variations. What really motivates one to take such a step? And sometimes I come up with new ideas what it was myself. First of all, it's like everyone, like Ajahn X and Ajahn Satcha and Lumpur Liam as a young man, we're kind of disillusioned with the ways of the world and saw the lack of genuine, say, gratification or like profundity or meaning in that. And it's not that I was too lazy to work or I didn't achieve what I was supposed to achieve. It wasn't that kind of frustration. I actually was able to finish my studies and do everything quite neatly. But the idea is this won't stop. It may continue. When is it ever going to stop? And this is one of the things which is the genuine feeling of I do really want to get out of the circle of becoming, whether it's, you know, as a Westerner, one doesn't really fully live with the concept of rebirth, so I can't say I had the motive of like breaking out of samsara or so, but like, I had a feeling of like, this can't be everything, you know, just like, and I had quite good friends, ethical way of life. I don't think I did anything really bad that I felt I had to cover up or run away from. I just felt even the good stuff that I was given from my parents, from my upbringing, from the opportunities I had, even this won't end, you know, like what's next, you know. There was a sense of frustration also with the coming a little bit from the Christian ideal that I was brought up with, which I think many of you might resonate with, because it's quite similar to the Mahayana ideal, which many of the Chinese origin Singaporeans might resonate with, the idea to do something for society. And this is definitely something I felt, oops, I'm not going to be able to do this in a thorough way if I don't get myself properly purified or like genuinely well as an set up as somebody who's really really okay with himself. I could maybe jump to quick conclusions, projects, do this and that, and maybe do a lot of things in that are charitable or so with a lot of energy. But if it doesn't come from a sense of inner purity, I really resonated with that, because in the time when I left for becoming a monk, there was a lot of very good social and political ideals around, and this is something in Christianity. Also, my generation, we grew up with high ideals. Like after, as you know, Germany has caused two world wars, and afterwards there was a sense of making people, making my generation also really grounded in a sense of being reasonable, being fair, being, say, politically correct, one would say later. But also like the sense of having to care for environment, having to care for like for the planet and things like that. There was a huge sense of responsibility, and at the same time, in the period when I was thinking about ordaining, or when I got into contact with Buddhism, there was a lot of crisis happening. Like there was the first Gulf War, for example, and even my university professors said, "Let's stop the classes and start putting in our veto against this crazy politics." So I had this strong sense of, this is not going to stop, the dukkha isn't going to stop. If there was only one person in the world that could be completely pure and a good example. So this idea, one has to start with purifying oneself, and it's very nice to hear that in Buddhism, actually the Buddha allowed people to retreat from the activist approach to life, to be perfecting oneself in a quiet, personal, humble way first. So that's one of the things that, different than Christianity. I was happy that somebody said, it's okay if you go to the forest for a while. I thought, wow, this is a great religion. They allow you to be genuine with yourself first before you help others. That's one, a few aspects. I think we can expect Longpo to arrive soon. I'm very happy to be able to sum it up like this, couple.
Okay, thank you, Ajahn.